The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
If you think that the constitutional crisis is complicated, that successful, obviously, if you want to use that term, assassination, has raised all kind of issues. What we do know from the government side is that you had 28 mercenaries that were part of that force that supposedly killed and assassinated the president in a very vicious way. There were 26 Colombians, and there were two Haitian Americans. The police said that they've killed three of the Colombians and that they've arrested 15 of the Colombians. So therefore, you have a few more on the loose, and it looks like they are going to be captured, but they are still not in the hands of the police. Now, why I say that this is complicated, it's simply in terms now of the operation itself. What we do know is that there was essentially no security detail in the residence of the president.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare podcast for July 13th, 2021. Last week, the country of Haiti was rocked by the assassination of its controversial president, Jovenel Moïse, who was killed in a bizarre plot, the details of which are still being uncovered. Moïse's death is yet another shock for a Haitian political system that was already in a state of crisis and has some calling for foreign intervention, a controversial proposal with which Haiti has a long and difficult history. To discuss these developments, I sat down with Professor Robert Fatton Jr. of the University of Virginia, a native of Haiti and widely published expert on Haitian politics. We discuss what we know about the assassination plot and what it may mean for the country and region moving forward. It's the Lawfare podcast for July 13th. Robert Fatton on the assassination in Haiti and its aftermath. Professor Fatton, let's start here. Tell us a little bit about who President Jovenel Moïse was prior to his assassination and the role he had come to play in the Haitian political scene.
Okay, well, Jovenel Moïse was, before his political career began, he was a businessman. He was in the banana export business. And he became friendly with the previous president, Michel Martelly. And Martelly essentially decided that he would be the candidate of his party. And his party is named Tête Calée in Creole, which means bald head. So that's the way Jovenel Moïse appeared on the political scene. No one had really heard him about him. And then he suddenly became the candidate of Martelly. And there were contested elections, a very complicated process, and he was eventually elected with very, very limited political participation on the part of the population. It got barely, I think, 15% of the vote. He was elected in 2016, but took power in 2017. So that's how Jovenel Moïse became president. He's essentially, politically, a product of Martelly's choice, and he was the dominant figure of his party, Tête Calée.
Now, prior to his assassination, President Moïse was involved with a dispute regarding his term in office and the period to which he would be able to remain as president. Is that correct? Can you give us a little background on that?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, when he was elected, his election itself was perceived by many in Haiti as being somewhat illegitimate. Afterwards, there were a series of massive protests about 2 years ago related to an investigation about Petrocaribe, which is a very complicated scheme whereby the government of Venezuela was giving money to Haiti and they were giving oil. But there was massive corruption in this, and some of the reports indicated that Moïse was part of that. So it is in that climate of political protest, political instability, that we get to the most immediate element of the crisis, which was that President Moïse extended his presidency to 2022, February of 2022. And there is a huge constitutional dispute about it, because when he was elected, that was in 2016, but because of the problems in that election, he assumed the presidency only in 2017. And the term of a president is 5 years. So what Jovenel Moïse argued is that he would serve 5 years and that he would leave in 2022. Now, the opposition and a large segment of civil society in Haiti argued, no, you have to respect the constitution. You have 5 years, you're elected in 2016, so you should exit in 2021. And he refused, and there were a series of protests as a result of that, but eventually President Moïse won that battle, if you wish, and he remained in office up till his assassination. This is only part of the story, because it gets extremely complicated when you look at the constitution. In Haiti, we have a constitution of 1987. That constitution was amended in 2012. And the chain of succession for the presidency varies very significantly from one constitution to another. In the original constitution, the president, if he died or if there was any type of vacancy, the chief justice would assume the presidency for a temporary period and then there would be elections. Now, the chief of justice died of COVID a few weeks ago, so there is no chief of justice. And the other justices are contested too. So that's a serious problem. But, and this is where things get even more complicated, the amended constitution of 2012 says it is the prime minister who should get power in case of vacancy, and he should run the country with the support of his cabinet. That would appear, therefore, that the prime minister is a legitimate successor of Jovenel Moïse after his assassination. But there are several twists here, because the prime minister, Claude Joseph, was supposed to have been replaced last week, just before the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. And actually, Claude Joseph had accepted to step down and to become the foreign minister of Haiti under the prime minister, Ariel Henry. So when the assassination occurred, Ariel Henry declared that he was actually the prime minister and that Joseph should join his cabinet as foreign minister. Obviously, Claude Joseph decided, no, I'm acting prime minister, but I'm in charge till we have new elections. And the international community, at least the UN, has seemed to indicate that they are supporting Claude Joseph. So you have two prime ministers, actually, or two people who are contesting the position. So that's part of the problem. Now, if you want another twist, and this is just related to that issue of succession, it is that according to the amended constitution of 2012, if the president dies or if there is any vacancy in the presidency, then it is the parliament which will nominate a provisional president. The problem is that we don't have a parliament in Haiti now. We don't have a functioning parliament. There has been no elections at the parliamentary level. So there is no parliament. But that hasn't stopped 10 senators who are still effectively elected senators to say they are going to support a provisional president by the name of Senator Joseph Lambert. And that is, as it were, a third, you know, part of the Haitian government. So you have two prime ministers, you have potentially a provisional president. And finally, the last twist is that if you go along with the 2012 constitution, which was amended, some constitutional experts in Haiti say that that constitution is not the real constitution because it was never translated into Creole. It was translated on, it was just written in French. And according to the original constitution, if you're going to have an amendment, the amendment has to immediately be published in Creole in the official government paper of record, which is called Le Moniteur. That was never done. So we are operating basically in a situation where the constitution is no longer valid because it does not indicate in any way who should be the president. So this is a situation which invites clearly a period of great volatility and instability. And there is a fight clearly between all of those different actors. And on top of that fight, you have the international community. And the final factor in that crisis is that you have had the emergence of civil society. And civil society that is extremely vocal, but rather poorly organized, and it does not really accept the legitimacy of the current government. And it is also very worried about the traditional political opposition. So you have different actors contending for power. The question then is, can you get a compromise between all of those actors that would set up a provisional government that would seek to appease the different social forces and generate a climate where you can have some election that will be perceived by the Haitian population as legitimate, free, and fair. So this is essentially where we are.
You've really given us this tour de force of the incredibly difficult situation that Haiti's found itself in regards to its prominent institutions. What has it meant on the street in Haiti for the last several years, even before this most recent trauma of the assassination? What has it meant for rule of law in Haiti and the effectiveness of its governance? One would think it would be a challenge even in normal times, let alone against the backdrop of the global pandemic. So how has Haitian society and governance reacted given these major questions about its fundamental institutions and constitution?
Yeah, well, we've reached a point of utter decay of the fundamental institutions of Haiti. I mean, we don't have a legitimate we don't have a president. He was assassinated and he was already contested. We have two prime ministers. They are contested. We have a provisional president that has been nominated by the Senate, is contested. And then we have civil society. The average Haitian, I'm not talking about educated elite and the fairly well-to-do people in Haitian society. I'm talking about the vast majority of the population. They are really outside the system. I think they've given up to a large degree on the government and on politicians. There was a resurgence, as I've said, of civil society in the last 2 years. And those are the very young people. When I say very young, students, some trade unionists, lawyers, activists, journalists. And that population is very, very young. I mean, if you look at Haiti, it has had a demographic transformation. Most people in Haiti now are people who are not only that young, but they are also without historical memory. You know, when Duvalier fell, most of that generation that was in the street never lived through the dictatorship of the Duvalier. And the only thing that they've known is crisis after crisis since the fall of Duvalier. I mean, you just look at what has happened in Haiti since 1986. It's a series of events that have led to an accumulation of small and big crises up to this very moment in 2021, when the assassination of the president has really been the extreme form of that expression of that crisis. Even in a country like Haiti, where we've had nasty dictators and very incompetent leaders, assassination of a president is very rare and in very different contexts. You know, the last assassination of a president was in 1915, just before the first American occupation that lasted to 1934. So that assassination is really a condensation, as it were, of the huge problems that Haiti is facing and has been facing. And for the vast majority of Haitians, you are trying to make a living. That's the bottom line. And there is a complicated new phenomenon, not entirely new, but much more pronounced. And that is the proliferation of gangs in Port-au-Prince and in certain major cities in Haiti. And those gangs actually have taken over part of Port-au-Prince, and the government has been unable to reimpose order in those areas. So therefore, you have a population that is really besieged, not only because economically it is suffering, but also because they are confronting the violence of those gangs. Initially, those gangs were targeting wealthy people. In other words, through kidnappings and things of that sort. But now, for the past 3 or 4 months, the phenomenon has really become widespread, and poor people have been attacked. And some sections of Port-au-Prince, you have had a significant type of warfare between the different gangs. They are vying for control of those zones, and very poor people have had to abandon their houses, and they are living in very crowded quarters in an area where the government has set up some sort of housing for them. So you have a crisis that is absolutely multidimensional, and the average Haitian, if he's healthy and if he has some money, is just struggling. And finally, in the rural sector, we have a huge crisis. And estimates are that about 30 to 40% of the population of Haiti is facing a food crisis. In other words, is facing the impossibility of having a decent meal once a day. So it is really a massive and despairing situation for the average Haitian.
So on top of all of this, the assassination of President Moïse is of course a major trauma and introduces another major shock to a system that has experienced a great deal of challenges. Tell us a little bit about what we know so far about the plot to assassinate President Moïse. We know it was executed by a set of primarily former Colombian military personnel, acting apparently as private security contractors or mercenaries of some sort. There were a few Haitian Americans involved, although some media reports indicate that they primarily claim to have served as translators for this group. And it ended in part in a shootout with Haitian authorities in which several of the participants in this attack were killed, but many of other have been arrested. And the facts are obviously still being developed and are in fact still coming out from Haitian authorities and others to this day. But tell us what we know as of the time of recording, as you understand it, about this plot and how it fits into this picture in terms of who may have, it seems, may have been involved and how it may have been intended to impact governance in Haiti.
Yes. Well, if you think that the constitutional crisis is complicated, that successful, obviously, if you want to use that term, assassination, has raised all kind of issues. What we do know from the government side is that you had 28 mercenaries that were part of that force that supposedly killed and assassinated the president in a very vicious way. There were 26 Colombians and there were two Haitian Americans. The police said that they've killed 3 of the Colombians and that they've arrested 15 of the Colombians. So therefore, you have a few more on the loose, and it looks like they are going to be captured, but they are still not in the hands of the police. Now, why I say that this is complicated, it's simply in terms now of the operation itself. What we do know is that there was essentially no security detail in the residence of the president. Otherwise, especially that you have armed people getting into his residence, you'd have had a shootout. And we didn't have that. No one from the security of the president has been killed or has suffered any injuries. And no one has seen anyone in the house of the president at the time, supposedly, of the attack. So that's one thing. The second thing, if, in fact, those mercenaries, and I'm talking essentially of the Colombians, are former military people with great experience in the fight against drugs and the guerrilla warfare in Colombia itself, one is really a bit shocked by the fact that they entered the residence of the president, they assassinated the president, and then they had no exit strategy. So why did they stay in the country? And there are very good reports that those Colombians were actually in their pickup trucks in the streets of Pétionville in the morning after the assassination. So how do you explain that? This is one of the questions that many Haitians have about the veracity about the assassination. The other interesting issue is that the two Haitian Americans were questioned by the police, and they've told the police that, in fact, they never intended to kill the president. They were there to seize the president, supposedly, arrest him, as they put it, and bring him to the National Palace. And there he would sign a document saying that he is resigning and someone else would become president. And this is where you have the last twist of the whole saga, is that last night, the police chief of Haiti, a fellow by the name of Léon Charles, has declared that they've arrested, actually, another Haitian-American by the name of Dr. Sanon. And what the chief of police has said is that Dr. Sanon was the fellow who was supposedly organizing the mercenaries and was supposedly going to be installed as president. Now, the problem with Dr. Sanon is that he has no popular basis in Haiti. Most Haitians don't really know him in terms of a political figure. And from records in the United States, because initially was located in Tampa Bay, well, he went bankrupt in Tampa Bay, moved to Miami, and then moves back and forth from Miami to Haiti. And last month, the police chief declared that he entered Haiti in a private plane. This looks like a crazy, frankly, incomprehensible story, that you have someone who has no political parties and is bankrupt, is going to hire 28 Colombians, pay them, and according to the Colombians, they were supposed to be paid around $3,000 a month and each of them. How in the heck could he pay that? So there are real questions about the veracity of the connection between the Colombians and that person, Dr. Sanon. Now, it may well be that he was a figurehead and that other forces are behind him. So those are some of the complications. There are further complications because we've had recently reports from Colombia and from a former Haitian senator saying that, in fact, they believe that it is the security of the president, the very security that was supposed to protect them, that killed him. And then they would blame the Colombians for the assassination. And here you have some apparently videos that were taken at the time of the assassination. The Colombians, according to the time that you can see on the videos, would indicate that the Colombians came at around 2 o'clock or 2:30 in the morning. And yet the government and the police in Haiti said that the assassination occurred at 1 in the morning. And the Haitian Americans who were seized by the police have argued that they did not kill him. And that what happened, they arrived there, he was already dead. And in fact, that they picked up his wife who had been injured and they transported her to a hospital. So you have a series of stories that are contradictory and so many questions that are unanswered. So this is where we are as of today in that assassination plot. We don't know who paid for it. We don't know who would benefit from it. And clearly, we don't know who's, as it were, the intellectual brain behind it and why they would have an assassination of Jovenel Moïse. He had many enemies, but I really doubt that the assassination would have benefited any of those people in the political scenery in Haiti.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So the close involvement of these two neighbors of Haiti, of Colombia and the United States, both which have kind of unique relationships both with the region and with Haiti itself. Obviously, it's a major Haitian expatriate population in the United States. Part of the reason why there's lots of some of the people involved of Haitian descent are originated in the United States in this assassination plot. And Colombia, of course, is known for being a place that, because of its large military, produces a lot of private security contractors or mercenaries that are deployed all over the world in different capacities. And frankly, during my diplomatic career, I worked with Colombian private security contractors. Lots of people who worked in government or for the United Nations have as well, because they're fairly ubiquitous. What does it tell us that these two countries were involved? What is it that brought them into the orbit of this sort of plot? Are there dynamics there about the type of relationship these countries have with Haiti, or is it just simply a strange coincidence?
Well, I think that the Colombian connection is fairly easy to understand in the sense that, as you just pointed out, the former military people in Colombia serve as security forces all over the world. And the Haitian government itself, a previous prime minister under President Moïse, declared something like 2 months ago when he was in office, that they were going to have some expertise coming from Colombia to deal with the gangs. Now, the question that some Haitians are asking, are those the experts that were supposed to fight against the gangs? Are those the experts who were supposed to protect, in some ways, if you wish, the president against the gangs? And there is no clear answer about that. So the connection between Colombia and Haiti is very much one about the security apparatus. The other connection, obviously, is the drug cartel, because Haiti has been used as a venue for the export of drugs throughout the Caribbean and the southern part of the United States, principally Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale. And there has been many documented stories of drugs coming from Haiti going to the southern part of the United States. So you have the drug cartel and people in Haiti who are involved in the drug and drug trafficking. Many of the gangs get their at least some part of their money from drug trafficking. So you have that kind of very peculiar military, security, drug connections uniting Haiti and the United States. Now, with the United States, clearly, you know, it's a very large Haitian community in the United States, and Haitian Americans are still clearly linked to the country to a large degree. The economy of the country would come to a halt if it weren't for the remittances of Haitian Americans to their brothers and sisters in Haiti. And the security situation is very much the same, because the security business in Haiti is booming, precisely because there is so much instability and because you have the gangs. So wealthy people, and to some extent people who are not that wealthy, seek some protection. If you go around the wealthy neighborhood, now you will see that they have armed guards in front of their houses, you have walls, etc. So there is some sort of security requirement in Haiti on the part of the very wealthy people. And that is very simply explained by the fact that you have a deep social and economic gap between the teeny minority doing very well and the poor majority. And that has created significant political tensions and grievances on the part of the majority. So you have a confluence of factors that really explain the presence of Haitian Americans and the Colombians. And there is finally the Miami connection, where apparently the security outfit that was recruiting the Colombians was located in Miami. And the other story is obviously that Dr. Sanon is someone who moved from Miami to Port-au-Prince, and that may be the link. But I doubt that ultimately that Dr. Sanon was the intellectual brain behind the whole affair.
Now, one of the more interesting recent developments since the assassination, particularly for a U.S.-based audience, at least, is the fact that we saw a call come from Prime Minister Claude Joseph, who you mentioned earlier, who's acting as acting president at the moment, or as that's my understanding, at least, Prime Minister, excuse me, who came out and made a statement essentially suggesting that a deployment of U.S. troops might be welcome or necessary to provide a degree of security in addressing the aftermath of this event. That request has been received fairly coolly and seemed to catch by surprise the Biden administration. I think the Pentagon spokesperson basically said this past Friday, we're looking at it, but don't have any plans to do anything along those lines. Instead, the Biden administration has condemned the assassination, of course, has sent FBI personnel who supposedly arrived there today or yesterday to assist in the investigation. But this opens up this kind of very long history of U.S. military intervention in Haiti over most of the 20th century. And each of the presidents really prior to President Trump was involved in military intervention in Haiti in relatively recent memory. Tell us, what does that relationship look like from the Haitian perspective? What led to these calls for U.S. involvement? And how does that fit into the political picture within Haiti that's arising after this assassination?
Yeah, well, Haitians have a love-hate relationship with the United States. And there is a very strong nationalistic feeling in Haiti. And if you talk to members of civil society and members of the opposition, the last thing that they would want to see is another foreign intervention, let alone an American intervention. They would see that as really a catastrophe. On the other hand, if you look at the immediate past history of Haiti and the United States, you have had multiple calls on the part of different Haitian rulers for some form of intervention. And the most dramatic was obviously the one that led to the restoration of President Aristide to the presidency in 1994, when you had 20,000 Marines who came back with President Aristide and put him back to power. Now, this is one of the most contradictory recent event of that relationship, because you may remember that when Aristide was elected, he claimed that he was an advocate of liberation theology, that he was a leftist populist, and that he didn't want to see American imperialism in the region. Now, Aristide was overthrown, and there are good indications that there was some connection between some members of the military, actually General Cedras and BMB, with the CIA, and that the CIA might have known that the coup was coming, and they essentially said, go ahead. On the other hand, the State Department apparently was against any type of coup, even though Aristide was perceived as being very radical and perhaps not the candidate that the U.S. would have wanted. Actually, there are good also indications that the U.S. wanted a fellow by the name of Bazin, who had been a prime minister and an economist at the World Bank, to be the president. But in any case, Aristide won that election. So you have that tension. And as we discussed already, that tension is reflected in the trajectory of Aristide. He's overthrown and he's claiming that the United States is an imperialist power, but then his return, thanks to Clinton and the Marines. And then the relationship between the U.S. and Aristide deteriorates very quickly. And the second time that he's elected, it doesn't last very long. As we know, the U.S., Canada, and the French were not too keen on Aristide. There had been problems in terms of the parliamentary elections, but they imposed an embargo. That was another type of intervention, if you wish, in Haitian politics. And there was open support for the civilian opposition to Aristide. And that eventually led to his forced departure. The French and the U.S. organized it, etc. So you have that tension between calls for intervention and very vociferous calls for non-intervention. So when we are talking about interventions, we have to keep that in mind. The other element about the intervention is that initially, when the U.S. intervened in 1994, there was very strong support for that intervention because it was perceived as restoring the presidency of a legitimate and popular president. But the way Aristide came back started to weaken his popularity. He had to change the economic policies that he had promised. He had to sign documents with the IMF and the World Bank to set the country into the neoliberal, if you wish, path of economic development. And he didn't want that, but he had to sign them if he was going to be restored to the presidency. So you have that love-hate relationship with the U.S. Then you have the U.N., which is also part of that foreign intervention history with Haiti. And as you know, once the American left after restoring Aristide, you had the peacekeeping forces from the UN setting up shop in Haiti. That one was disliked, but not so profoundly as the second one. The second really major UN intervention comes after the departure of Aristide in 2004, the second departure of Aristide. And that was the so-called MINUSTAH UN operation. And while Minusta imposed a semblance of order, and I'm using the term semblance because you already had gangs and they dealt with the gangs in a rather brutal way, but they had set the country on a different path with the gangs. The areas had been essentially, to put it crudely, cleaned up of the gangs with the military machinery of Minusta. That clearly was not something that all Haitians supported, because in the destruction of the gangs, a lot of so-called, to use a terrible word, collateral damage happened with very poor people in the slums. And what further alienated the Haitian population from the UN was the cholera epidemics that came as a result of the occupation. And the Haitians will never, I think, forgive the UN for first denying it, then reluctantly accepting that they were responsible for it, and never compensating the Haitian population. So you have very strong feelings against any type of foreign intervention. And the opposition, civil society in Haiti, have made it very clear that if there is a solution that is to be durable, it has to be a solution engineered by Haitians in Haiti. The foreign community can help, but they should not intervene in any forceful way in the internal affairs of the country. And there is some real anger about, in particular, the UN representative. A lady whose name is Li Mei, who has essentially said publicly that the current prime minister is the prime minister of Haiti. And that has not played well in Haiti, because it looks like it's a foreign interference in the affairs of the country, and that she has no business designating who's the prime minister of Haiti. So you have that kind of animosity that is obviously very present at the moment. And I could go on the historical background, because, as you know, the United States occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, and that has left a deep scar in the Haitian psyche.
Instead of going too far back in history, let's focus on the most recent chapter and pick up where you left off with this question of the United Nations. Because, of course, the most recent extended stint we've seen of a foreign presence, foreign involvement and intervention in Haiti was under UN auspices for more than a decade, really, until relatively recently, until 2017. And this, you know, presence has had this very mixed, very negative in many ways, regard in terms of some of what you've already noted, incidents of, you know, violent conflict in some cases, incidents of cholera spread and disease, incidents of sexual abuse and violence, very credible accusations against some of these UN peacekeepers. But there are also some who say that this was a more successful model in some regards, or at least provided a baseline of security. We actually saw the Washington Post editorial board come out with an op-ed essentially asserting as much, recognizing the failures of the UN presence, but also saying, but at least they secured a level of stability that seems to be lacking here. Is there any sort of appetite for that view, either internationally? Do you find that view credible, or is that overstating the level of success even the international mission was able to accomplish on that lowest common denominator of stabilization?
Well, there was a limited stabilization, but if you're going to have such an intervention and the end result is a stabilization that has no roots, as it were, because once the troops exit, things fall apart again, then it's difficult to say that this is the type of stabilization that is going to offer Haiti a real path to a different political dispensation and social dispensation. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not going to have an intervention. My own personal feeling is that if Haitians can't get their act together and fairly soon, there is going to be some sort of intervention. I doubt that the Biden administration is going to send American troops to Haiti unless things were to fall suddenly apart. And that would be a very sudden and you have massive chaos. Then that might happen. I assume that what we will have is very much the same thing that we had, you know, after the departure of the American troops in 94 and after the departure of the French and Americans in the immediate aftermath of the forced departure of Aristide. That is to say that the so-called core countries, and they call the core countries essentially Americans, French, Canadians, and some Latino American countries, will probably put forward some kind of dispensation whereby you would have troops coming from the UN or from the Organization of American States. They'll call them peacekeepers. And that may well happen. I think there is a window of opportunity for Haitians to try to get a major compromise so they can have a government of national unity and the possibility of settling the disputes that we have now in a peaceful way and creating the context within which you can have elections. But I don't think, this is another contentious point, I don't think you should have elections in September as some people are calling for. I think that would be a disaster. There's no way that you can have elections at this time because the Electoral Council that was put together is not accepted by civil society or the members of the opposition. The logistical operation for having some legitimate elections do not exist. You have gangs in the country that have, as I've said, occupied significant portions of the large slums existing in Haiti. And then you have the possibility of a resurgence of COVID if the strongest variant of the pandemic were to arrive in the country. So I don't think this is the moment to organize elections. And then you have, obviously, the assassination of the president. I think elections have to be organized properly and that you have to have a government of national unity before you can even think about organizing elections. You know, elections ultimately in the context within which they've taken place in the last two occurrences have been disasters because the person who wins is immediately contested. Few people participate. And instead of consolidating a democratic practice, it really alienates people from the democratic system. Those type of elections, in my mind, are very dangerous if you want to really consolidate democracy itself.
You've anticipated my next question, which was exactly about those September elections that the Biden administration and the United Nations have both seemed to continue to support, despite concerns along the lines that you've outlined there. I suspect that part of the reason they support them is that elections seem to present the clearest institutional route to the formation of another sort of governing entity that may have some more legitimacy, more effectiveness. Although, as you've described, I think very aptly, there are many reasons to doubt that that's necessarily the outcome that's going to arise. I think one of my last questions for you is what are the alternatives there? You know, what is the alternative route to arrive at a government of national unity or some other political arrangement that could more effectively organize elections moving forward, more effectively perhaps provide some semblance of security or other conditions that will allow for effective elections in moving forward? And what is the support the international community needs to provide to accomplish that, particularly as military intervention may prove controversial, and there's reasons that people have raised doubts about how effective it really can be. What are the necessary ingredients the international community needs to bring to the fore to put those conditions in place?
Well, I think if the international community is to have a constructive role, I think it is to encourage not only the current government and the traditional opposition to get together and reach a compromise, but also to integrate into the negotiations what, for a better word, you might call civil society, that youth that has emerged in the political system. In other words, have concerted Haitian discussion and a concerted Haitian negotiation that hopefully would lead to some sort of real compromise between the different forces. That is extremely difficult in the context of Haiti because the political actors don't like each other. Not only they don't like each other, but they see themselves as illegitimate. If you ask, you know, people in the opposition whether Claude Joseph is a legitimate prime minister and his government, is it legitimate? They would say, no, there's no way. A similar response on the part of civil society. Now, civil society has serious problems with the traditional opposition. And when they emerge, they wanted to demarcate themselves from the government and the traditional political opposition. So you have a very complicated political scene in Haiti. But I think if there is to be hope, is that the crisis is so pronounced that it may compel actors who really don't like each other to accept a solution under which all of them could cooperate and have a legitimate outcome at the end through elections. But that would need real negotiation between all of those parties. And it may well be that you don't want the international community involved in this except to tell them, yes, get together. We are not going to intervene. You have a window of opportunity to do it. And you may have organizations that are outside the political system, as it were, to lead those type of negotiations. I mean, Haiti is a very religious country. So you could conceive of the Catholic Church. You could conceive of the Protestant churches and also of the major religious force in Haiti, which is essentially a Vodou forces who are organized and recognized in the constitution. You take those forces, it's a very complicated and bizarre solution, but compelling Haitians to sit with Haitians and having a certain moral commitment to having an outcome that will be different from the previous outcomes. So that's a possibility if the international community encourages that. But if the international community says very publicly, well, this is your prime minister and you are going to have elections in September, that to me is a recipe for disaster and for further complications in the really profound crisis that we are facing now. And it may lead to an international occupation or some sort of intervention precisely because the vast majority of Haitians do not recognize that government. They want an alternative government. So it's a very narrow path towards some type of compromise. And if it doesn't happen, the country may indeed fall into further disorder and ultimate chaos. And that, unfortunately, I think would open, if you wish, the door to some sort of foreign intervention that the vast majority of Haitians do not want. And it may well be also that the Biden administration doesn't want to have troops elsewhere, especially after what is after Afghanistan. I mean, there may be a reluctance to put troops, although Haiti is a very different context. And to put it crudely, as some American policymakers put it, it's the backyard of the United States. And you may have a significant crisis in terms of migration and boat people and humanitarian crisis. So all of those things have to enter into the equation. And policymakers, both in Haiti and in the international community, have to think seriously about the implications of their behavior. And it's a very serious and probably the most serious crisis, political crisis, that Haiti has faced in decades.
We will have to leave the conversation there. Professor Robert Fatone, thank you so much for joining us today on the Lawfare Podcast.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to rate and review the Lawfare Podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you might be listening. Also, to gain access to an ad-free version of our podcast and other benefits, consider supporting Lawfare on our Patreon account at www.patreon.com/lawfare. This podcast was engineered by Hamza Shitu of Goat Rodeo and edited by Jen Patcha Howell. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.